welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 251. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today, just the two of Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
And James Jones.
I killed John Lindemann.
Yep, we killed him and ate him. And he'll be back in a couple weeks because he's high in fiber. So, yeah, John just had a friend in town and couldn't come. And so we thought, you know.
Likely story.
We kind of blew our load last week with the 4.5 hour podcast. So, you know, we were thinking, well, let's do a kind of a quickie this week to continue the innuendo. So this will be a shorter show. We're just going to catch up on some listener mail. And we have gotten a lot over the past couple of weeks. We did have a big call-in thing last week where we covered some of the same territory, but a lot of those were more quick answer type questions. So this week I think we'll get a little more in-depth, but it will be a short show. It's going to be down to one segment. There's no new business or anything like that. And then next week we're actually going to take a real vacation from the podcast, which we do very rarely, about once a year on average. I hope you're okay with that. Wanted to let you know ahead of time. Don't look for an episode next week. But you'll still have the newscast. There should be a new radio trivia going up very soon with myself that we recorded while 2IP was out in Colorado, and that was really fun. So there's a lot of stuff going on, nevertheless. So this week, we're just going to jump right into your listener mail. And Greg, why don't you read the first letter?
An anonymous listener writes, regarding Operation Rainfall, I genuinely believe Nintendo of America will be bringing both Xenoblade and The Last Story over, but they aren't ready to talk about them yet. Something to keep in mind is that for a Japanese company, the euro currently holds more value than the dollar. Nintendo themselves have personally lost a lot of money on the dollar, which is perhaps why you've seen NOE releasing more of these niche games than NOA, because they can afford to. Other Japanese companies are doing this too. Namco Bandai recently announced the flood of Naruto, One Piece, Dragon Ball, and Saint Seiya games for Europe. Something else to keep in mind is that NOA could potentially be saving these games for next year, when they feel that there's nothing else coming for the Wii. This year, at least there's Zelda, Rhythm Heaven, Itadaki Street, or Fortune Street, and so on, but support next year is going to be scarce. Its most internal development will be focused on the Wii U /3DS, and third parties certainly aren't going to pick up the slack.
Don't get me started on Fortune Street, because John Lindemann tweeted a whole shitload about Fortune Street.
Fortune Street might be a cool game. I know the Japanese version had some good comments on it from some people, and it was kind of a surprise that they're bringing it to the West.
Yeah, because it has no cultural cachet here.
Yeah, it's just not going to be a big deal. I mean, it's going to be a minor release. It's going to sell less than Wii Party did last holiday season. You know, I'm not complaining that it's coming over, because obviously I wish they would bring over more games from Japan, but this one is, it's not exactly buffeting the release schedule for the Wii. It's a line item at best.
Do we know that Rhythm Heaven's going to be coming out in any of the Western territories this year?
No, that's unconfirmed.
Because it is about to release in Japan.
Right.
But, you know, if you look at, say, the DS version, Rhythm Tengoku Gold, there was a several-month sort of localization delay with that one, mm-hmm. You know, because they got to redo the music.
It is a deceptively large amount of localization in those games.
Yeah, and they just may decide to hold it until January or February or something like that, you know, for schedule reasons. I would say, you know, I've lived through a lot of very bad end-of-generation cycles from Nintendo. Super Nintendo actually was one of the better ones, I would say, but N64 was atrocious.
Oh, God.
The year 2001 was really, really, really poor for N64.
Oh, was it Conker?
Conker and Paper Mario?
Paper Mario, maybe, or maybe that was just Europe.
Conker, I want to say, was like a March or an April release,
yes.
So after that, forget it.
And the GameCube came out months later.
Yeah.
In November in America, September in Japan.
GameCube had a truly abysmal final year before Wii came out, and Wii has already had a really terrible year, and the new system isn't even coming out this holiday season. It's good. I think this problem is actually worse on Wii than it is on its predecessors, and I don't think Nintendo's track record shows that they're going to do anything to mitigate this. And by the way, with these three RPGs or quasi-RPGs, if you were going to release them, you wouldn't do it all in the same year. So it would make a lot. If they were actually holding these to kind of peter out the Wii, it would make a lot more sense to release at least one of them this year and then another one next year. So I don't buy the argument that they're holding all of them off until 2012. And quite frankly, the people who want to buy these games are happy to buy them now as opposed to next year. So it really doesn't make any difference. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to hold them off. You're not going to build up a larger user base for these games in the meantime.
But we talked about this on the live show, but if they're holding it because they were waiting for a better time to talk about it, they had their better time to talk about it. They had a week and a half of coverage devoted to these games way out of proportion for what these games are actually going to get coverage-wise any other time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you contrast that with what Nintendo of Europe's done. I mean, you know, obviously release dates change for various reasons. Can't really be absolutely certain, but, you know, the fact is they announced the release date for this game to be September 2nd for Xenoblade in Europe, just, I think, coincidentally in the early stages of the whole Operation Rainfall thing. And then just a couple of weeks later, they announced that they were actually going to release it 2 weeks earlier than they'd said and put it into August. You know, it seems pretty clear that they thought we want to get it out as soon as possible to sort of capitalize on all this free publicity that we'll have basically a sort of radioactive half-life, you know, is going to go away. So we need to try and capitalize on it as quickly as possible.
I mean, you can pretty easily point to when the whole thing started to spin up. Xenoblade sales went up in Japan.
Yeah, that's right. It's just, you know, if people are talking about something for whatever reason.
And people are importing it too, I would imagine.
I would think if they're going to import it, they would just wait until the European version came out then. Because it's going to be in a language they speak.
And it's not far away now.
I would say ultimately the spike is Japanese in origin. I mean, at least the majority of it is. Because it wasn't a small spike. It was a noticeable increase in sales numbers for that game.
Probably because its sales numbers had trickled down to a very low level that point, because it has been out for more than a year in Japan.
And the whole thing got real coverage in Japan. I mean, there was a noteworthy amount of news coverage of the whole Operation Rainfall thing in the Japanese media.
Oh, that's really cool.
In fact, we had a Yahoo story that one of our Japan correspondents gave us a brief summation of, which is basically, it was just the normal facts of the story, but it was very weird to see it written in Japanese about a protest about a game in America that they've had for a year.
Well, I think if there was a big grassroots effort in Japan to bring over an American game like L.A. Noire, I think you'd hear about it here. I think people would be really interested to hear about that, you know, and also would feel proud that, well, of course, that game's made in Australia, so that's a bad example. But, you know, if it was some American-made game, I think American gamers would feel proud that another country is really feels passionately about bringing these games over.
Funnily, L.A. Noire did manage to top the Japanese charts this week.
It did. It did really well there.
Wow. That's cool. I mean, I know there is a kind of hardcore Rockstar fan base in Japan. GTA usually does pretty well. Capcom's actually been releasing the past few GTA games in Japan, and they've done fairly well for themselves over there.
Yeah, they usually spike up. Like, I mean, I was shocked to see that GoldenEye for Wii managed to get in the top 10 for 2 weeks. The first two weeks it was on sale.
GoldenEye's a big name, even in Japan.
Yeah, it's still kind of impressive, but a lot of the time the FPS games, like, you know, show up and vanish like a comet in Japanese charts, I guess.
Or just don't show up at all.
Well, yes, it's certainly some of the lesser ones. I don't know whether we'll be seeing Duke show up.
I hope so. The Duke needs to show up.
Wouldn't count on that.
Now, regarding the point about the currency issue, the euro, now it's worth mentioning that the euro has been worth more than the dollar in an absolute sense since about 2003.
Yeah.
Yes.
That particular part of it is nothing new. But obviously, in the middle of the Wii's lifetime, there was a financial crisis, at which point the dollar became worth rather less. So the euro is worth more relatively. But, I mean, at the moment, it's pick your debt crisis. I mean, I think Nintendo would be concerned about currency fluctuations with respect to America and Europe. I don't know how much that's playing into their decision making about, you know, how safe is our revenue.
Well, and here's another point of it's at least worth noting, is that the strength of the yen relative to both currencies.
I was about to say that.
Yeah, they're losing it both ways. Certainly, it was more severe with the dollar a few years ago. That was very pronounced. But I think pretty much everything seems to have lost value against the yen. It just keeps appreciating.
And if you go back and read their investor QA from 3 weeks ago now, one of the investors basically, so first off, and apparently you only have to own a little bit of stock to get into an investor QA, and there's no check on if you're an idiot or not. Because about a third of the questions are the dumbest thing I've ever heard asked by anyone ever.
I think generally speaking, you only need to own, you have to own at least one share in order to participate in a shareholders meeting.
But there were some just moronic questions involved. But one of them basically was discussing, you know, why does Nintendo convert its money into foreign currencies? I don't like losing money on this thing, is essentially what he said. And Iwata, his response was almost a little bit snarky when he said, well, we can't expect them to pay in yen, is essentially what he's what he said. And his comment was basically that the yen is one of the stronger currencies on the market right now, which is kind of weird because for years it was flagging a little bit because if you remember, the economic crisis hit Japan way in advance of everybody
else. It's pretty much been going on for a long time, 20 years.
And they're just sort of living in it at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, their debt-to-GDP ratio is way bigger than any of ours, believe me.
But for the sake of the conversion rates, they're actually doing quite well if you're going the other way at the moment.
But if for people like Nintendo that draw a lot of their revenue from outside of Japan, sure, it's bad news. And the point is, I don't know that there's a sufficiently sort of reliable, stable disparity between Europe and America that would explain a sort of strategic difference of like what we're willing to put out in one region versus another. I mean, another thing that Iwata said in the past is that he thinks people in Europe are sort of more willing to try new things. Perhaps that maybe they sort of get in ahead of certain sort of trends compared to the American market. But I think that's really to do with, you know, casual, what we might call casual, you know, expanded audience.
Yeah.
Kind it seems of stuff. To me that Nintendo of Europe is more interested in getting into new things than Nintendo of America. But I don't know that that's true of the actual cultures.
Yeah, it's so honestly, I'm just at a loss to explain it.
I
think it's just an honest to goodness difference of approach from the people that are making these decisions at the local level.
It comes down to you know, increased autonomy for the branches, and what you're seeing is that Nintendo of America is taking, I would say, a less conservative approach than they have in past generations, but compared to Europe's extremely open approach to bringing things over from Japan, America looks bad in comparison. I mean, I've said it before that Nintendo of America has probably done a better job this generation than they did in the GameCube or in previous generations about bringing things over. And there are more things to bring over overall because Nintendo releases more games than they used to. But
yeah,
it's it just compared to Europe, it's kind of embarrassing.
Well, you know, I wonder if the situation might have more to do with where the management team is from. Because, I mean, Shibata manages Nintendo of Europe, and I'm not sure who the decision makers are.
That's true, I suppose, yeah. Maybe there's a bit more of a direct link to NCL.
To the mothership.
There is like a CEO or something of Nintendo of America who's Japanese, who's from the corporate headquarters. And I remember when Arakawa left, or pushed out, maybe. I guess he technically retired. But this new guy, I can't even remember his name because it hasn't come up in so long. And he never really seemed to be very hands-on or have a lot to do. I think maybe he was a bit of a figurehead. And right after he started there, they also hired Reggie. And Reggie started out as a vice president of corporate whatever.
Right.
And then about a year later, Reggie was promoted to president of Nintendo of America, and he was the first Westerner to ever hold that position. And from what I can tell, I think Reggie is actually managing the day-to-day operations. I think he's making the big decisions, whereas his boss, the guy from Japan, is really kind of behind the scenes, and I don't know that he writes the checks or something, but, you know, I don't think he's really all that involved in the decisions that are made. I think they leave it up to Reggie, and I think that's a difference between Iwata and Yamauchi. You know, Yamauchi wanted his man over there, someone like Arakawa, his
son-in-law,
to do whatever, because Yamauchi really ran Nintendo of America for 20 years.
By proxy, yeah.
Exactly. So he wanted a guy there.
Barely by proxy.
Yeah, and Iwata's like, no, I know America's a different place. I want an American running it. And so I think Iwata has ceded a lot of power over to Reggie and given him a lot of autonomy. And it's one reason you see a difference in approach here. But one other thing I wanted to mention, Operation Rainfall recently declared a partial victory, or they announced that it was looking more likely that these games are coming to America because of a couple things. First off, they first reported, and I think this just riled people up even more, that at least Xenoblade, if not the last story, actually had a demo at E3 that Nintendo of Europe was not allowed to show because Nintendo of America didn't want them to. Okay, so that got people riled up. Then a separate report came out saying that someone, some source of Operation Rainfall's, they have some kind of anonymous source from within Nintendo, and this person claimed that there's actually an NTSC version of Xenoblade that's been floating around in America around the time of E3. And so they said that they believe this points to an imminent announcement of these games post E3 for America. I would say those two stories are actually linked, and very likely the NTSC version had been produced for Nintendo of Europe to show to their press at E3 because there are no PAL TVs in Los Angeles.
Well, and the Wii versions are probably from NOA anyway. I mean, NOA provides
the Wii
everything.
Systems, yes. The Wii systems, the capture units, everything. Yeah.
There's also, I mean, you have to consider, for instance, if you call back to Disaster, the situation there, there was a story that NOA actually adjusted the vocal tracks. Now, because they were already in English.
But terrible.
But they wanted them sort of redone to play better for an actual, you know, English-speaking audience. And so I do think the version that Europe got is the somewhat different voice tracks version. But of course, they did that and then never put the game out in America.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems plausible to me to have a version prepared that could be launched in America, but then they then decide to sit on.
They did it with Mother.
Yeah, the Earthbound Zero, as it's referred to.
I mean, that was a long time ago, but this certainly wouldn't be the first time they've done it.
It does happen. You know, it could be perfectly plausible that they've, you know, because the costs are not that high. I don't think this is about cost, at least not in the monetary sense. The only thing I could imagine if they think it's some sort of opportunity cost in terms of marketing bandwidth, and this sort of, even that stretches credibility with the sparse nature of the Wii lineup right now. But you know, I don't think it's a cost issue. I think they could well have these, you know, given that they have been translated to English, you know, something that's for American consoles that could work, that maybe they adjusted the spellings or whatever, that could be launched in an American market that they may never actually bother to release just because they, you know, in their judgment commercially, it's not worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, you know, at this point, I still think it's a possibility that these games will be published in America, but I don't think that Nintendo of America is sitting on an announcement. I think if they end up bringing it to America, that's a decision that has not been made yet.
Mm. There would be something that would prompt them to.
Maybe they should look at their release schedule. Maybe that will prompt them.
Look, I don't see the problem. We have Fortune Street, as this letter pointed out. It's an obscure board game from Japan, kind of like Monopoly, yep, with Square Enix and Mario characters. What else do you need? What else do you need? That's a year's worth of gaming right there.
Maybe they're just going to do like the Metroid Prime trilogy treatment. And
where
package
they're
gonna
put
all three of these together on one disc for Wii U.
Yeah, that's not happening.
No, it's clearly not happening. But okay, the next letter is from Jay in Tampa. I wanted to address something that bothered me a bit about the discussion of Operation Rainfall in episode 249.
I'm smelling a trend.
Is it me, or has the general gaming public become way overcritical of what is coming out, or what is, quote, owed to them for simply being a consumer of a product? I'm not specifically talking about Xenoblade, The Last Story, or Pandora's Tower problem, but that is part of it. There have been a lot of people complaining about things like Nintendo naming the new console Wii U, or that new games don't measure up to hype, etc. It's as if the gaming community has become a bunch of drug addicts. They become used to a specific level of their drug of choice and need a stronger fix. Then they get the stronger fix and become used to that, and again want more. We've become spoiled, and frankly, I get tired of hearing it. These companies don't owe us anything. They have been providing us with something to do for over 25 years. They are offering us interactive experiences that we should be happy to have. Granted, they may not always be exactly what we want, but how can you please everyone all the time? I don't know, maybe I'm too easily entertained. P.S. Is it hypocritical to write an email bitching about bitching?
he kind of that did, you know, while I was reading the letter, I was thinking, well, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
What do we owe you, Jay? If we've been giving you something that you don't like, we can't please everyone all of the time.
Mm-hmm. I was really mad he became self-aware at the end. I really thought I was going to have just 20 minutes of me making jokes about hypocrisy.
About the irony value of it, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's funny the language that Jay uses here, because he says, these companies don't owe us anything. And then the next thing he says is, they've been providing us with something to do for over 25 years, as if they're giving it away for free.
As no, if they're, I'm paying. They're...
Yeah, we're giving it away for free. We're definitely entitled to that.
That's right. So I think, though, one logical mistake he makes here is he's conflating multiple issues that don't belong together. You can't. You can make fun of the Wii U name because it's a terrible, terrible name. Mm-hmm. And it's not making an implicit statement that they owe me anything. They didn't owe me a better name. But that doesn't mean I don't have to make fun of the name Woo, because I'm going to. They made this decision. Deal with it.
I think not only is it a bad name, I think it's ultimately doesn't do much for them in terms of business.
Yeah, we've touched on that before.
Look, we're commentators. That's the kind of stuff that we talk about. We're going to say that. If we think it's a bad idea, we're going to say so.
That's the point. I mean, what we try to do here is, because we're passionate about the subject, is offer our takes on it. But, you know, it's best to be not entirely emotional about it. I mean, I think that's probably what Jay is most sort of annoyed by, is where it kind of just, you know, it's the internet. So not so much in this venue, but there's plenty of venues online where people tip over the edge into hysteria, hyperbole, whatever you want to say.
I do hate John because he is the worst person to ever live. So,
you know, that is kind of the environment that we're in, and you could apply that to anything. You know, if you've been following the NFL lockout stuff for the past 100 days, it's like, the sky is falling, they haven't reached the deal now, this is terrible, they're betraying the fans.
People take personal stakes in these things that, I mean, yes, in some sense, we, the three of us, and John too, are outside of this, and we're looking in and trying to analyze it. We're playing armchair CEO or whatever, or we're just playing consumer advocate, you know, but we're trying to analyze this stuff and provide a perspective on it. But at the same time, when it comes to stuff like the Operation Rainfall games, I do have a stake on it. Now, as many people have noted, because the game is coming out in English, thank goodness, I can import these games. And if it looks like that's the only way I'm going to be able to play them, then I will import those games.
Yes.
And Nintendo will get my money one way or the other.
It's just going to Germany first.
This is going to be very circuitous.
Yeah, and they're going to lose money on exchange rates and things, most likely. But Nintendo of America certainly won't get my money, but maybe that's immaterial considering they're a wholly owned subsidiary. They don't have separate stock.
It might look bad for a couple executives, but besides that, I don't particularly care.
It's bad for Reggie, you know. It's bad for me because I have to go through a lot of trouble to play it.
I don't particularly care if Reggie can walk into his bank and do a Hulk smash pose as he deposits his latest paycheck.
It's bad for me in that I won't get Club Nintendo points for it, and I'll have to install some dumb firmware crap that I really don't want to deal with. I would be happy to live through the rest of my life without having to install custom firmware on my consoles, but I will do it if I need to. And I'm going to have to go through a special website and pay top dollar for import fees and such to get a copy of the game. Or I'll ask Carly to buy one and ship it to me.
There you go. Still,
but I'll have to pay extra shipping. It will cost me extra, and it will cost me extra trouble, but I can do that. Here's the problem. I only have this opportunity because, thankfully, Europe is translating it to English. Now, if they weren't doing that, then this would be a very different argument. I would still be angry that I'm not getting to play these games, but then I wouldn't even have that recourse. So on principle, the same thing really does apply. But the only reason that we have an easy out in this situation is because importing into English is actually a viable option.
So here's what I would debate, though, as the fundamental premise of Jay from Tampa's thesis here, is his concept that they don't, quote, owe us anything. But I would argue that when they sold me that system, they weren't selling me a piece of hardware. They were selling me a venue with which to play games that they therefore promised they would be providing. And ultimately, they do owe the consumers of their system to produce at least a stream of games from which they can then consume.
Well, it's not a contract, but it is an expectation for certain.
Right.
It's implicit as well, mm-hmm. You know, and especially when we can look and say, yeah, there's another Western subsidiary that is making this decision.
Yeah.
It naturally invites puzzlement and query as to why they are doing what they're doing.
Two, in fact, are. One, Nintendo of Europe is localizing it, and Australia has decided they're going to bring it in too.
Sure.
I think the other point you could make, though, is that they're not serving a specific set of fans here either. And I don't mean in this in the general sense. I mean, there's a very specific type of fan that has not been well served on the Wii this generation that would like to play these games. To extend beyond this, part of the issue that we have this generation in particular is that this generation hasn't been real great for the JRPG genre anywhere.
No.
Well, console-wise, yeah.
Right. Well, I kind of split them off into separate generations, I guess.
The sad thing is that the late-era release of Xenoblade and The Last Story in Japan was actually seen as one of the bright spots for Japanese RPGs this console generation. And that is sort of being denied to us. So those of us who do celebrate the genre in the West, this is very bitter for us because we've actually been waiting a long time for there to be...
Right. And that's where I was headed with this, was that... These were kind of held up as like, look, it's not dead. Look, it still exists. See? Mm-hmm. Right here. I got it. And then, but no, you don't. Take this over here.
And these are also supposed to be the harbingers of Dragon Quest X. And Dragon Quest, I have no doubt. I have no concern whatsoever that Dragon Quest X is coming to America. But I think it's going to be more difficult for Nintendo of America to sell it if they pass on Xenoblade and The Last Story.
Well, that's why they got Fortune Street, so we can get familiar with the Dragon Quest characters.
Maybe they should just reissue Dragon Quest Sword.
Well, I do think, though, I mean, just on the general point that Jay's bringing up here, that, like I said, there's definitely plenty of times around gaming or anything else where the tenor of it does get out of hand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it probably could be worth reminding that it is what it is. It's about... products, it's about businesses selling to customers rather than blood pacts or anything like that.
Wait, you didn't have to do that?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are definitely people who build up senses of entitlement. And maybe what I'm about to say will sound entitled to some people like Jay, but I have exchanged many thousands of dollars with Nintendo of America. Yes. And at this point, I'd like to think there's a certain amount of trust between them and guys like me that we will actually buy this kind of a game. And I think Nintendo of America is really disregarding that. And yes, in the light of the way that they have sold the Wii and the people that they have marketed to, and more importantly, the kinds of games that they have pushed on the system, it really shows where their priorities are at right now. And this is not just about these three games. This whole movement and the whole upsurge of passion about this is really a buildup of what's been going on for the past 5 years. And it's nothing new for our podcast. We've been talking about this for a very long time.
It's a cultural shift.
I think this has been a little bit of a tipping point kind of thing, because it kind of just all comes together where it just appears that it'd be so easy to bring them over, mm-hmm. and yet they're not, that it really kind of typifies things.
It's like someone else is already doing the work for them. Basically, they just have to put an American label on it and take my US cash.
And that even then, they're not forthcoming. So I think it has built up to a kind of a flashpoint. So, you know, maybe some people's reactions might seem out of proportion about these three games. Like, people say, oh, do you really want these games that badly? You know, I mean, not that they're like not good, but JRPGs aren't hugely popular right now in the Western markets or whatever. But it's also because it's sort of just a representation of kind of pent up frustration, I think, that a lot of people feel. And, you know, we feel that too as well. And we, I think we try to be sort of measured and critical in our thinking rather than just hysterical. But, you know, if we didn't care, if we didn't have emotional investment in it, we wouldn't be doing this at all.
And if you didn't care, you wouldn't be listening to it.
Yeah, so we're never going to act like, oh, well, just business though, isn't it? It's just like, you know, if you're a fan of a sports team, you've just lost the penalty shootout in the World Cup finals. Oh, it's just a game though, isn't it, mate?
Right.
actually, it's more like if they've just traded away their best player because they don't want to pay him. Oh, well.
That's sour grapes.
You're not going to help anyone by saying, oh, it's just a game though.
If you want another view on this, a very, very well-spoken view, I would recommend going to YouTube and do a search for a video titled, Nintendo, Why Won't You Let Me Give You My Money? And it's really well done. It's like 5 or 6 minutes long. This guy has a great radio voice, and he lays it out very, very well. And he makes the point. Now, this is based on VG Charts numbers, so you have to take this with a week's worth of sodium content, but
salt lick.
He makes the argument that out of 43 Wii games that were published in both Japan and in America that were quasi first party,
Nintendo involved.
Yes, with Nintendo involved, one way or the other, 40 of those 43 sold better in America than in Japan.
Well,
and the specific numbers that he cites are highly questionable, but I think that trend is accurate.
There are market factors that you have to put in play there, too.
It's a larger market.
Well, it's a much larger market, but there's also higher geographical challenges.
Yes. I mean, the cost per unit for Nintendo of America to distribute is higher than it is in Japan.
Well, and the cost of advertising would be higher if they advertised.
Sure. So you could make the argument that they would have to sell more copies in America to break even than they did in Japan. But again, it's really in Nintendo's hands to sell these games. They're not a puny company. They're not some fly-by-night operation. If they want to sell people a game, I believe Nintendo of America has proven to be fairly persuasive in that arena over the past couple of decades. So it's really a matter of will.
Right. And our point example of games that they couldn't sell, ExciteBots, they had no will to sell that game.
They didn't even try.
I mean, I didn't even remember that it existed until I saw it at a store. And I write for a Nintendo-focused website.
Yeah,
Think about that.
That says a lot, really, doesn't it? So it's really up to Nintendo. If they want to sell these games, they can. They've just chosen not to, in more ways than one. And now we need to move on. James, please read the next letter.
Adrian writes, I've noticed a number of people fail to beat Zelda games because they get stuck in a dungeon. So, will the fact that the whole overworld in Skyward Sword is said to be a puzzle-based hurt the game? Second, am I the only one who will miss having an overworld that you can freely explore in Skyward Sword? And his third point, does Skyward Sword need a super guide system, or the Zelda games in general? I think this option benefits players that are less determined. At the same time, I'd like to see harder difficulty settings as an option in the Zelda games.
Yeah, the overworld issue, I mean, obviously you guys, you know, got to...
No, not really. No overworld in that demo.
Not in the playable demo, but in the round table, there was the showing off of the Siren Realm or whatever. That's going to make up some component of the overworld. I think this is really what Adrian's talking about here in terms of the puzzle-based element. Around E3, Aonuma, when discussing those sort of Siren Realm bits, the idea that basically you'd come back to certain locations doing different things. So like sometimes it would be in this Siren Realm situation where you're stripped of your equipment and you don't even have your sword because he sticks it in the ground, but then you're finding these different things, and I guess it's like an element of a kind of environmental puzzle. But then in another case, you'll come back to that same place and you will have all your equipment. And so you'll be doing something different there.
I would imagine that the Siren Realm stuff would be, you would know that you're about to get into that. So
it'd be encapsulated.
Yeah, if you just want to run around and freely explore, then you can do that. But I would say like in Link's Awakening, that's a puzzle-based overworld.
Yeah.
It's difficult to even move around without doing a lot of item switching and figuring out how to deal with all the obstacles in your
way. Why is there a bear singing in my way? Move, bear.
In some cases, you're looking at this grid-based map, and in some cases, even moving three blocks to the right on the map can be fairly complicated, and sometimes you're not exactly sure how did I get over there the first time. And I remember I found the early in the game I found the seashell mansion, and then much later in the game when I thought I might actually have enough shells to do it, or I wanted to check or whatever, I tried to get back to it. And I actually couldn't find it because it's just in this. The map isn't very helpful in showing you the connections from one grid space to the next, and it was kind of tucked away in this little place, and there's only kind of one way in and one way out. So yeah. I don't think this is anything new for the series, and again, if you're worried about the Siren Realm, I got the sense, very overwhelming sense, from seeing that demo played at the roundtable at E3, that it was very similar to the Twilight sections in Twilight Princess, where you're playing as the wolf and you're running around collecting drops.
That's what I thought of, the tears of light or whatever.
Yeah, you're collecting tears again.
And of course, in that case, you were the wolf at that point until you collected the tears, so you didn't have your sword.
Mm-hmm.
You had these kind of more restrictions on your movement, so it does sound similar.
Yeah.
But we'll have to see exactly how it's got, if it is sort of implemented in a more puzzle-like kind of fashion than a scavenger hunty kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would be my hope.
Right.
Because, I mean, otherwise, I think when you get into the realm of scavenger hunts, I think you're kind of bringing up some of the issues that I've mentioned before about the game being padded.
Yeah. I mean, really, it comes down to we don't have a great idea of what the overworld's like, so it's hard to answer this question.
And there's also the dual elements. We've got the sky situation.
Right.
You know, seems like Link's going to travel a certain extent on the bird, but then we've got on the ground, you know, the sort of the world below where they make this siren realm stuff kind of goes on. So we don't know how they kind of interconnect.
And can I just say that I'm not a fan of timed sequences in any Zelda game. I'm having a difficult time thinking of any of them that any timed sequence in a Zelda game that I think is actually fun to play.
You don't mean like a mini game, though.
I mean anything that is timed. Anything with a timer or some kind of graphic on the screen that's depleting.
The entirety of Majora's Mask?
Yeah.
Does that count?
Well, that's different.
And I know it is.
It's very different, actually. No, yeah. I'm talking about, yes, there are mini games. There's also, you know, like the Siren Realm stuff that they showed. He made note that this meter, it's like a flower or something on the side of the screen. This meter, it kind of fades after you get a teardrop and you have to find the next one before the power of the previous one fades away, which translates into like 10 or 15 seconds or something like that. It just seems like that's just the kind of pressure that I don't really appreciate when I'm in a game that is supposedly puzzle-based.
Well, but then again, I mean, it could be something of a puzzle in itself in that, well, how do I get from one doodad to the next in quickly enough that I can actually keep that timer going? I mean, it could be a different kind of puzzle solving. And I think that presumably would be the objective of having this kind of gameplay is to break it up, do something a bit different, you know, so you're not like doing big sword fights all the time because that probably wear people out with like Motion Plus or just traveling and expanding for ages, like Wind Waker with the sailing or whatever. I guess they probably don't want to do a whole lot of that to get monotonous as well. I think that's the objective, and the point is just whether there's enough substance there, and we're obviously not really in a position to say that yet. But I mean, I think really, like, you're right. I mean, overworlds in the 2D games, like Minish Cap, I would say as well, you know, they do have puzzle elements. You do have to sort of like reach out as you gain new abilities to traverse them. It's only really kind of once you got to the 3D ones that you had just this big, like, it's just Tyrol Field. Yeah, you
could sparse.
Yeah, just go where you like. I mean, I wouldn't miss that terribly much as long as, you know, the gameplay that's put in there to kind of make it feel more structured delivers.
Another good example were the Oracle games where you'd have to change season or whatever to get around.
Time period.
Just to be able to pass to the next screen. The one thing I wouldn't want, though, is this to be an impediment on my ability to travel from A to B quickly. If I've already made that movement one time, I can already get...
Especially, re-traversal, that's right. Yeah, where you say, you've made this journey once.
Let me get there.
Yeah, I don't mind going back through it if it's going to be different the second time. But in Zelda games, typically, once you've made it through a stretch once, then you have everything you need to make
And to me, that would be fine, or more fine, if it's just a straight shot and it's just riding through nothingness. But if it's puzzle solving again, the same puzzles.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what we do know is, like I said, you've got this difference between being there with the Siren Realm and then being there when it's normal.
And if the world is dynamic, then I don't mind going through multiple times. If you're going to give me different things to do every time I go through there, then I'm interested in that. I think that could be really cool. But, you know, the problem is, and this is actually a problem in a lot of Zelda games, is that there is retraversal, and the world is very static. The enemies show up in the same place. I mean, even the very first Zelda game, those Octoroks are going to start in the same positions every single time, and you might have to go through that screen 20 times. Well, it's pretty challenging and interesting the first 5, but the last 15 times you go through there, it's really kind of a chore because you just want to get to the other side so you can do the next thing that you actually haven't done yet. So you're always pushing towards the things that you haven't done. And it's frustrating when they make you go through things that you have done repeatedly to do that. Like we've said about the Metroid games, at least in those games, you do tend to have different abilities. And also the levels tend to be designed in such a way that you can go through them in a different way as you return later on. So if you play the game fairly efficiently, you might only have to go through one area maybe 3 times, and all 3 times you might be very different as a character. And so the experience is different. In Zelda, I tend to find that that's not the case so much.
Well, are we ready to get to the other half of the question, I guess?
Yeah, difficulty in Super Guide. Well, I mean, it seems like Super Guide is pretty much a given of some sort. You know, what we've seen whether it was the original patent application, alluded directly to Zelda with Legend of Blank, and
right.
like, you know, sort of all these sketching out how it would work with like hint movies and stuff. We've then seen that sort of implemented to some extent with Ocarina of Time 3D. So that may well be the blueprint for how they're going to put it into a Skyward Sword, or they might even go a bit further with Skyward Sword because it is a new game, you know, from the ground up. They might sort of have it be a bit more sort of implemented. But yeah, I mean, I think that Nintendo, this is a concern of theirs that people get stuck in a Zelda game and don't end up finishing it. So they want to sort of mitigate against that with these sorts of things that they've developed in the past couple of years. That's pretty much a bankable thing. In terms of like variable difficulty settings, it's not something that they're terribly fond of in general.
Not gonna do it.
So
wouldn't be prudent.
So for reference, though, first off, that was terrible, Johnny. But for reference,
you don't like my Dana Carvey?
No, it's awful. But it was awful when he did it too, so that's fine. That's fair. But what people have found, this is going to sound very Big Brotherish, is games now do track your progress, and that is reported back to the developers and publishers. I mean, they know if you beat games, how far you get into games, where you get stuck. And I've read multiple articles where developers said they would review this data after the game's been out and be like, wow, people tended to really stop playing at this point of the game. Or in this area, people would get stuck and spend a lot of time here. And they would go back and review their design and see what they could do in future games. But the vast majority of games bought are never finished. That's just the way it is. And it's not intrinsic to Zelda. That's just the way the industry is. Games are bought, they're played for a bit, and they're put away.
Because John Lindemann buys them all.
Well, no, I said they're played for a little bit.
Yeah, precludes John from a number of
these. That's the big difference between me and John. I will at least start my games.
I know what you mean. I think there's plenty of people who don't finish a game and it's got nothing to do with them getting stuck. You know, it's just like they start playing something else or they start reading something else. Yeah, they get out of it, and then once they get out of it, it can be difficult to get back into it. And so I think what Nintendo is just trying to do with stuff like Super Guide in Mario, you know, that new Super Mario Bros. Wii and Galaxy 2 and you know, Ocarina and presumably Skyward Sword, is just to at least not give people a reason to give up, you know? Like, they probably accept that a lot of people just will. And, you know, obviously if they've already bought it, then that's not a tragedy for Nintendo. But I think there's a word of mouth issue. If people finish a game, they're much more likely to say, hey, I finished this, you know, and say something about the ending, or, you know, there's a sense of accomplishment for them that they finished it, so they're more likely to talk about that. It's just a very human thing to do, is just tell people about something you achieved in a way. So I think they want to take out as many impediments as possible to people finishing a game. And, you know, as for the difficulty setting kind of issue, probably Metroid is really the only game that has consistently had selectable difficulties if you go back to, like, Fusion and Prime.
Did Fusion even have one?
He had easy and normal.
Oh.
And I think it had a hard in Japan. And then Zero Mission has easy, normal, and hard. And, you know, the Primes all have that. But if you notice, what they always do is they make the hard unlockable. They never give you that choice.
Didn't Ocarina of Time 3D.
Yeah, and I hate it.
Yeah, they didn't either. That's exactly what I was coming to. You know, that old Metroid Prime Trilogy, which is, of course, a re-release as well, they did not give you the option to just start at hyper mode, which I would have done. That would have been my preference.
Yeah, that's silly, because most people who bought the trilogy already owned at least two of those games, if not all three.
Exactly.
So that was really silly.
I think that's the point I'm trying to make, really, is that I think by the fact that they won't even let you do it there, select a high difficulty seemingly from the get-go in something like Prime Trilogy, which is a re-release, they're just philosophically opposed to that.
Yep.
They just think, no, we will never let players do that, because, you know, they might select it and get angry and then not play the game at all. And presumably that also means they're opposed to you like turning the difficulty down in the middle of a playthrough, which you could do with stuff like Bioshock and any number of modern games, you know, made by Western developers.
Well, the good thing about Zelda is that if you want to play a harder version of Zelda, don't pick up heart pieces. Actually, the heart containers are optional when you beat a boss. So you can beat the whole game with 3 hearts if you want to, and that is very difficult. So if you really want a harder challenge, go for that. You know, I mean, it's like, goes back to like Mega Man. Some people like to play Mega Man without using energy tanks and stuff like that. That's fine. Yeah. If you want to do that, go ahead.
If you're a sadist, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this with Billy, I think, a long time ago when Super Guy was first announced. We had Billy on the show.
That's right.
And we spent a whole feature segment talking about difficulty. But the Super Guide is unobtrusive. It's completely optional. And I think it's much better than a bulk difficulty level, because if I'm stuck at one part and I'm not sure what to do, or I'm just having trouble getting through it, I don't necessarily want to reduce the difficulty of the entire rest of the game. I just want a little bit of help to get through the one part that's tricking me.
Galaxy has that issue.
And learn from whatever they show me, and then move on with that and become a better player after that, rather than bring the whole game down and be less satisfied with it after that point. So I much prefer the Super Guide method, and I haven't even used it.
No, I fall into the same camp, and I think with someone like Zelda, I mean, it's really important because, you know, how would you reduce the difficulty of some of these puzzle issues? Or, you know, that's not something that you can really do by
shoot arrow here,
lowering some stats. You know, you pretty much have to provide hints or literally do it for them. So
give them detective vision.
I think it's going to be a positive thing, whether you ever use it or not. You know, I think it's a wise thing to have in the game. But I do hope that it will, you know, as I think it has done in the Mario games, give them the courage maybe to make certain other aspects of the game that don't pertain to puzzle solving a bit more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that is something that Miyamoto has kind of expressed, that, you know, maybe, you know, some of these games we've been so kind of timid about not wanting to put people off, that we've made things pretty forgiving, and maybe if we have this sort of Super Guide thing in there, we don't need to be so preoccupied with that.
Well, and you saw that in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, you saw it in Donkey Kong Country Returns, you saw it in Super Mario Galaxy 2. Not with Ocarina of Time 3D, but that game already existed, and it does have the Master Quest in it. So yeah, I think generally what you've seen is Nintendo games have become more difficult since doing the Super Guide, which is what we hoped they would do, and they followed through with it. So I think that'll continue.
Yeah, I'm happy with it. I'm really happy about that. And of course, because Skyward Sword also, you know, very different in terms of like the combat and stuff, seems like it might be more skill-based. I mean, I think this could be satisfying in a way that a Zelda game has not been, at least for a very long time.
Yeah, if you watch people at E3 play Skyward Sword, it was, and last year as well, it was quite clear that people were really wrestling with the control scheme and were finding the combat to be more engaging than they had in the past, because it's not just as simple as approach and push a button. So, I mean, you know, at some point it becomes not a good thing anymore if it's too difficult or too frustrating, but it was quite clear that even people who were familiar with Zelda were having difficulty defeating enemies. I mean, I think I was with TYP when we got to go back in the private area. We just basically asked the right person and got really lucky, and we got taken back in this private area with a bunch of corporate people, and we got to play Skyward Sword a little bit, and he played the boss level, and he was having a hard time because his sword swings weren't connecting. He was just kind of waggling it, you know, which is a habit that we've all picked up, I think, on the Wii, especially if you play Twilight Princess. And so Link would just kind of toss his sword around and just kind of wave it in the air. And I said, Mike, if you want to hit him, you're going to have to swing it. And he did. And it worked. So, I mean, I think it's great that you're actually having to put a little more effort into it and also think about what you're doing a little bit more. It could be very, very good for that game. And it does certainly present a new challenge that we haven't had before. So, you know, if nothing else, I think Skyward Sword will be challenging in that you're just going to have to relearn how to play Zelda.
Yeah.
So, Greg has the next letter.
Wilson writes, seeing as the Wii U's big innovation is the screen on the controller, do you think this is as innovative as the Wii was back when it was revealed? What do you guys see Nintendo consoles being capable of in 10 years down the line? Mind control? Just curious about your opinions. Yeah, it's I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that it's as innovative as the Wii was, you know, back in 2006. But having said that, we really haven't seen the kind of breadth of applications that they would bring to it yet. I mean, that's a real sort of test, is going to be what happens with the software. I mean, I don't think the idea of just putting a screen in the controller is, you know, something that's sort of radical.
It's not, because they've done it before.
Yes. I mean, you know, especially with the connectivity angle, GBA and GameCube, it isn't in the same way. I mean, yes, you say, well, we're going to combine it with motion control and all this, but it's much more iterative and sort of, you know, about combining elements rather than sort of introducing something entirely new.
You saw it with Scrabble on the iPhone and iPad. You've seen it in the VMU with Dreamcast, and yeah, you saw it with DS and Wii in a very limited number of applications, and most importantly, you saw it with GBA and GameCube. So it's an idea that's been around for a while. I mean, the thing with the Wii Remote is that the motion control had been done before, mainly on the PC, and, you know, there were a couple of weird peripherals along the line on consoles, but they never took off at all. They never had any kind of support from software. And so this was Nintendo saying, well, the technology's improved, and it's become cheap enough that we're going to put it in every system, and we're really going to build the console around motion control. And no one had ever done that before. And that was a big deal.
And to the extent that you were sidestepping, you know, the usual technical arms race and pinning it all on that, you know, I mean, yeah. I think, you know, to the extent that the idea was innovative, or certainly it was groundbreaking, you've had this very strong sense that they were actually going to leverage it a lot. And, you know, in some ways, the reality of it has not been what we might have expected. It's not been as groundbreaking as we might have thought, because, you know, there were certain limitations to the technology. Ultimately, we've seen Nintendo kind of go into this creative retrenchment where they go back to side scrollers and, you know, Punch-Out and all this kind of stuff. That's the thing with Wii U. The idea in itself might seem like it's more of a kind of iterative thing, but they may be able to create more innovative software with it. I mean, we haven't seen that yet. Certainly the stuff that they had at E3 was not so much in that category. You know, the whole chase me thing, pretty much Pac-Man versus.
It's a fun game, but it's not mind-blowing.
Work of art. Work of art. Draw a line that is exactly 16 centimeters long.
Yeah, that
is a game of the year material right there.
I really chuckled when Chris Kohler called that like one of the best things that they showed on Wii U.
I think
Measure Up is...
in a way, it was one of the more exciting things to play, only because it was truly two players competing against one another.
Yeah, that's something that you would maybe pay 99 cents for on the iPad.
Yeah, it is.
The difference is you have a stylus on the Wii U. But I mean, that was not an impressive demo in any sense, technical or otherwise.
One of the most sort of what seemed to be innovative kind of angles on having this second screen in the controller was almost the more sort of AR type stuff. Mm-hmm. So you've got that central view on the TV, but with the controller, it's almost like a viewfinder, like looking into any part of this world that you're in.
Yeah, the pirate,
you know, 360.
Game.
Yeah, the pirate game sort of played off that concept. They showed a few other things in the video that suggested how that could be used. You know, that seems more sort of genuinely new, rather than just like, hey, we put the HUD on the controller.
That's
already
been done on the iPhone 2. I mean, I hate to keep going back to that, but there's Stargazer applications where you can hold your iPhone up to the sky and move it all over the place. And
oh, yeah, but
you,
like, I mean, what I'm talking about is combining that with the TV as well. That's well, going to be the interesting part, is that you've got, you know, obviously 3DS is doing, you know, a certain amount of that stuff with the gyro and that, but here, how you could combine or almost like switch between, okay, just looking at the TV and interacting with it that way, and then interacting with it in this kind of AR kind of way, that there could be something that feels fresh maybe from that avenue.
Yeah, I could see so. But overall, this is partly Nintendo playing catch up with technology, and quite frankly, it's easy to forget in light of this gigantic, you know, touchscreen controller that they showed. But one of the major features of Wii U is that it still works with your Wii controllers, and that they are planning software that is exclusive to the new system that is played with the old controllers. And I think that's a big admission on Nintendo's part. Not only that they want to do some kind of carryover marketing thing with, you know, that was the most innovative thing about the Wii, is their marketing approach to it, not so much the controller. But it's pretty clear that Nintendo is acknowledging that their motion control potential was constrained by the technology of the Wii, and quite frankly, constrained by the imagination of developers and their experience yeah. level with that kind of input method, which is now much deeper than it was 5 or 6 years ago. You know, and of course, the new controller has all that stuff in it, too. It may be a little bit unwieldy for certain kinds of games, but I think you're going to see quite a number of motion control games on Wii U that maybe don't use the touchscreen much, if at all, and maybe you just play them with your Wii Remote and Nunchuck, but you know, I think there's still a lot more to be done with motion control, and Nintendo doesn't want to cede that over to Microsoft and Sony, especially Microsoft, with Kinect,
yeah.
now that they've entered the market, because if Nintendo said, well, it's all about this touchscreen, and this is our new controller, and you know, the old, you can still use a Wii Remote on Wii games, but our new games are using this big thing, then I think they would really, not only would they have cost problems with everyone having those controllers for local play, but they'd really be kind of saying, well, we created this huge market for motion control video games, and here you go. Our competitors can have it. We've moved on to the next thing. They can't do that because the innovation of motion control is so big that we actually couldn't process it completely at the time, and we couldn't handle it really with the technology that we put it on. So now we're going to do that again, but better. That may not be the most exciting thing for some people, but I think there is more to be done with motion control, and I think having it coupled with better online and HD graphics and a touchscreen controller as well, you know, and the asymmetric local gameplay, I mean, all that stuff is exciting. Depending on the software that comes out with it.
Well, we've talked plenty of times about how, you know, Motion Plus support has been so slight, and you know, that they really haven't, you know, done very much with it in Nintendo themselves. In particular, they've done Wii Sports Resort, and Skyward Sword is on the way, and they didn't bring out Zangeki no Reginev that supports it, and that's most of what you could say for how they've kind of done with Motion Plus. So, starting, you know, on the new system, you know, maybe they will take that in different directions. But I mean, this whole asymmetric multiplayer thing, I mean, it has to be a humongous part of the system's sort of whole appeal, really, because I mean, what's the Wii been about, really? It's been about local multiplayer.
Yeah.
Wii Sports, yeah, from the very beginning, Mario Kart, Smash Brothers, New Super Mario Brothers Wii, you know, pretty much all the big sellers, they have this very strong local multiplayer component. And now what they're bringing to it is the idea of, well, you know, we're going to have one person with this weird big screen controller and everyone else with the Wii remotes. And
it's an odd strategy.
It is an odd strategy from the point of view. It's not yet been proven that those products can be hugely successful, that they have the sort of instant appeal that creates a big hit.
I just think that it's difficult to market that. For one thing, it's difficult to show yeah. in commercials or demos. That's a tough sell for Nintendo. I mean, I'm not saying that that concept doesn't have a lot of potential. I think it's an element of that system that will be less important to me personally than some of the other features that it's bringing to the table. But, you know, I think it is cool, and I think there will be some things that they do with it that I will want to take part in. But I think for the mass market that they've been very successful with, that's going to be a hard sell, just because it's confusing and it's difficult to show off, and it's not obvious that it's a better way to play video games with each other.
It is definitely a marketing challenge, but like I said, I mean, that is, right now you have to say, like, the sort of major breaking point with Wii is like, well, obviously we're still going to do Smash Brothers, we're still going to do Wii Party, Wii Sports, so they're going to have analogous games to all of those, but we can also give you this that's fun to do with your friends or your family in the same room, which, you know, especially I think in Japan, they almost feel like that's the only reason why people have consoles anymore. It's like, well, you know, because I mean, Wii Party in Japan is a mega hit. It's humongous.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's verging on 2 million sold. So, you know, it's outsold like the two Galaxy games combined.
Yeah.
The one where you hide the remote in the couch and make your friends look for it.
It is a party of parties.
Is it, I mean, the point is that this local multiplayer is the central plank of their console strategy, because they think that is, you know, what shifts units in Japan as consoles now. Mm. You know, because I think portables have become so powerful there in many other respects. So it's going to have to be a huge part of what they do. But, you know, as you said, it's not easy to actually carry that message through. So they've got a real test on their hands. But at the end of the day, I think the onus falls, as you know, as much as you talk about marketing, on the developers to just come up with something, the software, not the hardware, the software that's innovative and compelling, and that ultimately, once people play it, they get it and they talk to their friends about it.
James, can you read the next letter, please?
Synaptic writes, during the previous episode, you guys touched on something that I think is important with respect to Wii U's potential success or failure. The ability to port games to it from other successful platforms and vice versa. Whereas one might see the new controller as a big negative in this regard, I see it as another tool to expand the Wii U's library. Now developers can develop a game for phone, tablets, and the Wii U. This is already something that has worked reasonably well for the DS with ports like Plants vs. Zombie and Peggle, but the DS cannot handle many of the iOS or Android games developed for more powerful smartphones. With the Wii U, we should expect to see ports of games like Infinity Blade and Sword and Sorcery. I think this is how the Big N sees itself competing with the likes of Apple, even if that is a misguided approach. I'm interested to hear what you all think about that.
It's an interesting comment, but I don't think Nintendo's really interested in those kinds of games. I think Iwata's...
Well, moreover, the limitations of the touchscreen, the fact that it is not multi-touch and not capacitive and all that, it's not really going to lend itself to play those games.
And I would say that feature is subject to change. I think they've gotten a lot of feedback after E3, and there's still plenty of time before Wii U comes out, and I think it would behoove Nintendo to go with a capacitive touchscreen. And you can still include a stylus, just make it a capacitive stylus. And I think that would be... They're going to get laughed at a lot if they release this very expensive controller with very old technology like that.
Well, I mean, that surely would be the reason why it wouldn't have it, as it currently doesn't, is cost containment. Mm-hmm. As we know, Nintendo is very conscious about that sort of thing with the components of their hardware. But, I mean, I think the biggest problem is that when you've got a screen of that size, I think a lot of people are just going to expect it to be like other big screens of that type, touch screens of that type, which are capacitive and multi-touch. So when it's not, they're just going to be like, ugh.
The pressure-based touchscreen is... I mean, try playing your 3DS with your finger. Try playing your DS with your finger. It really doesn't work that well because it's not that responsive. You actually have to push on the... with a certain amount of force on the screen. And then once you do that, there's so much friction on your finger that's actually somewhat difficult to drag your finger elsewhere on the screen, which you often don't need to do on DS or 3DS games. It's more about tapping. But you can imagine that on a larger screen, you're going to be doing more dragging, and you can't drag very easily with your finger across a screen because of that friction. So it just doesn't feel natural. I mean, you can do it, but it doesn't feel natural.
Yeah, I mean, also, I mean, with, for instance, just with Ocarina of Time 3D, if you really want to be quick about, you know, using that touchscreen inventory management, you are going to use your thumbs rather than, you know, pause to get the stylus out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's doable. You know, it doesn't feel that great because, as you said, you do have to sort of push down a bit against it, but you can manage it. But, you know, with something like the Wii U controller, it's going to be very much the same thing. If you're holding it in both hands, playing an action game using the dual circle pads and the buttons and all that, and then you want to do something with inventory management, you're not really going to want to, you know, let's get the stylus out, right? Let me pick that. Now let me put the stylus back in. You know, it's taking away some of that convenience of having, you know, an inventory management on this dedicated screen that, you know, you apparently is important enough that you've got a system that can do that in the first place. So, I mean, it definitely would be a big thing if they did sort of bring the screen up to spec. But as I said, they may be so concerned about selling it, you know, I mean, they're not going to sell a controller separately, it would seem. They're not going to contain costs on it for that purpose, that it would be cheap enough to sell as a sort of separate controller, because they basically said, you know, we're pretty much not going to do that because they would be too expensive. But still, they're protecting their margin on selling the hardware as a whole, you know, the system and the controller together.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of this style of game, in terms of a cell phone type of game, there will be third parties who will want to do that, and maybe they'll push Nintendo into making it available, you know, but the problem is these games will cost more on Wii U than it will on the phone, and it'll be more difficult to get because you'll have to download it through the console because the controller is not actually that portable. You can't take it outside of your home, so, you know, it'll be like buying things off the Wii Shop Channel. Maybe it'll be an improved version, the Wii U Shop Channel. Maybe it'll run better and everything, but you're going to have to turn on the console and go to a certain place and look for this stuff and then pay twice as much, at least twice as much, as you do on your phone. So I think if you want to play that kind of a game, this is not really a very good way to do it. So I don't know how many people are going to want to play Angry Birds on their Wii U controller.
Well, there's probably not a reason to really covet these games because the current rate, attach rate for the handheld devices these games are natively being built for is increasing at a relatively exponential rate. I would say in the near future, these games on cell phones are not going to need secondary devices to be able to play them because you'll already own something that does natively. I mean, ultimately, smartphones outsell normal cell phones. So the people who own Wii U probably already own a device who can play these games in a format that's more conducive to playing them on a mobile setting.
It'll be that ubiquitous.
Right.
But it will be essentially irrelevant. Yeah. Well, that's what I said. I mean, you know, the only way you could kind of branch it out on the Wii U is just that, you know, well, a phone is kind of a private thing for one person. Whereas, you know, the whole concept of Wii U or Wii before it is it's inclusive. It's for the family, bringing people together in one room around this one thing. But
right.
That would mean that they would be similar but different experiences, like a different spin on the same kind of experience.
Right, which means ultimately you have to develop a different game.
Yeah.
And at that point, why not just make a game? I mean, granted, I could say that, but we're getting an Angry Birds movie, so fuck, I hate everyone.
Well, I think the point is your widespread ports wouldn't be any kind of plank of the platform.
All right, and our last letter of this episode is from Hamed, who writes, I've heard lots of complaints about the circle pads on the 3DS and the Wii U, but no one seems to be looking at it from a reliability point of view. Analog sticks are great, but they tend to wear out and thus don't last long. Games such as Super Smash Bros. Tend to speed up this process. When it's on a standard controller, you can always get a new one. But when it's on an expensive Wii U controller or on a portable, that would be an issue. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, certainly it's going to be a sort of issue with these Wii U controllers. Presumably, you're going to send them off to be serviced if something right. goes wrong with them, much like you would do with a portable or a console, indeed, because you know, they've said they're not going to sell them separately, as we said earlier. But as to whether a circle pad is more reliable in the long term, more robust...
We don't know yet.
That has not been put to the test. I mean...
Yeah, well, I'm sure internally it has been. Nintendo, as a manufacturer, does something called mean test of failure and things like that.
Yeah, everybody, any company worth their anything will put their devices in a tester that just repeatedly issues stress on them to see what they can withstand. But we don't know the results of that testing.
Right, and they haven't stated that that's the reason they went with circle pads. I mean, I think with 3DS, it's pretty clear that they did it for profile reasons.
Form factor.
Yeah,
right.
For Wii U, I think that is less obviously the motivation. So.
See, when I wrote about this in my impressions of the controller, which are really good, by the way, not to brag or anything, but to me, it felt like it made it easier to shift down to get to the other things on the controller because it was so low. Because that thing is actually, I mean, it's really light, but it's a big thing to hold in your hands. And having the thumbs closest to my fingers as possible did help. Because it's very big, and even though your thumbs are on control sticks, they are providing a stability role on that system. More so than they do on like the classic controller, where your fingers wrapped around the back are providing the stability role.
Yeah.
On this thing, your thumbs are playing an active role in keeping this thing balanced. So having them close and tight, and the ability to move off the buttons or the sticks quickly does help a bit.
You see, you've got a firmer grip, and you could just, as we call it, the slide pad and all that, it's easy to slide your thumb from one part of the controller to another.
Yeah, it is.
I didn't get that feeling when I play. I didn't feel like they were much lower to the surface of the controller than most of the modern joysticks are.
I would say they were roughly quarter of an inch closer to the controller surface.
Well, I also think that this problem could be mitigated another way, like, for instance, adding some kind of bumps to the back of the controller for the rest of your fingers to hold on to so that you can balance it better. I think the Wii U controller as it is probably a little too flat on the back. I don't think it needs to be that flat. So I would prefer that they gave you more to fill up that space in the palm of your hand and give you something to wrap your fingers around, and I think it would be a lot easier to hold it that way. And then you wouldn't, you know, the advantage that you saw, I didn't see that advantage, but the advantage you saw would not be necessary.
To me, I had no issue with the circle pads on there. I felt they were fine, and they worked for me too, so, you know, whatever. I mean, I beat Ocarina of Time and didn't think about it for a minute that I was using the circle pads.
Yeah, it was fine.
I don't mind it nearly as much on 3DS because I think it's just, it feels better. The one on the 3DS actually feels better to me than the ones on Wii U.
So that's weird though, because the ones on the Wii U are supposedly a noteworthy higher tech than the ones on the 3DS.
Who says that?
They did. Nintendo said this. They described them as like second generation circle pads or something along those lines.
I didn't think they felt very good at all. Also, most of the games they showed didn't really use it much.
Honestly, the game that used it the most was the Ghost Recon game. The demo ended in like a minute and a half.
Yeah, and again, I think it's worth noting that New Super Mario Bros. Mii did not even use the circle pad. You had to play that with a D-pad.
I don't know. I mean, that New Super Mario Bros. U or whatever the hell, or Mii or whatever the hell they were calling it, that whole thing was kind of like a, I don't want to say a rush job, but it was like they went into the Wii level editor they built for the original game and threw it on Wii U.
That is bizarre as a showcase. I think it's utterly bizarre.
Yeah.
It has no applicability in terms of using both screens. It aesthetically, you know, you're talking about a game that already had a very simplistic visual style that really doesn't benefit beyond a bit of extra crispness from having HD graphics applied to it.
And also, if you wanted to play it in multiplayer, everyone had to use Wii remotes. The only way to play it on the new controller was to play it by yourself, in which case the game only showed on the controller itself. It was a very, very strange demo setup.
The fact that you could have your Miis in the game could be done on Wii, I think.
So. Certainly.
What was very strange about that demo most of all was when the PR rep basically demanded we all play, all four of us with the Wii remotes, play watching the Wii U hand screen. So despite the big TV there, she was insistent that we all look at this controller to play this next level.
So you couldn't play with it in multiplayer, but everyone else could play on it in multiplayer.
That was what we were doing. I don't know what the limitations of the game were. I just know that it was the weirdest experience because like everybody crowd around so you can see it better. I'm like, but there's a big TV right there.
So if Daddy wants to watch his fishing show on the big TV, but the entire rest of the family wants to play a video game, I guess that's a good option.
I bought this TV, damn it.
You're living in my house.
My house, my fishing.
Did you pay for this TV?
No.
All right. That's going to wrap up the show. Thanks to everybody for the great emails. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we'll do our very best to get to more of your emails on the next episode of Radio Free Nintendo, which is coming up in 2 weeks. Stay tuned for that. Of course, once again, you can always check out the website, NintendoWorldReport.com. We didn't have Now Playing on this episode, but there is some very good content up there, and you should go check it out. We've got new reviews and previews and lots of news all the time. And some editorials lately, too. We've been very active on that front. Of course, we've got the podcast. We actually just hired someone specifically to edit the newscast. So the newscast will live on, and Mike Sklins is becoming more involved as well. So our creator,
oh, no.
Our progenitor,
oh, no.
Is over there messing around at the kids' table. I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, don't worry. He'll lose interest in about a week.
Well, it's always good to hear from Mike, of course, and he's really fun over there. So you definitely go listen to the newscast, especially when we're off for a week. That's a great excuse to go over and check out that show if you haven't already. And Radio Trivia is on, and it should be coming out very soon, starring yours truly, along with 2IP, and we did an all-listener request show, so that's really fun, so you can hear what other people wanted to hear. I believe there are 3 NES games on that episode, which was a real treat for me, because I love me some NES music. So yeah, we had a really good time recording that as well. Definitely check that out, and a little bit after this show comes out, just a couple of days after this show comes out, we should have a new episode of Discover Music Project, my other show, with John Lindemann and Amy Lindemann, his wife. And we're going to be talking about Stevie Wonder. So I would highly encourage you to go check that out, because Stevie Wonder is the bomb-ass awesomeness. And you get to hear John talking about music, which you know he's very passionate about. And you get to hear his fabulous wife, Amy, who is a podcast star. I can't believe this is her first podcast. She's hilarious, very witty and observant. I'm so glad we had her on the show, and we're going to have to do it again. So definitely go over and check that out. It's at crosstalk.com, or you can go to iTunes and search for either Crosstalk or Discover Music Project, and let me know what you think. That's all, folks. Stay tuned. We might have some details on the new Retroactive during our downtime, so stay tuned to the website and facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo, as well as our Twitter account, which would be Nintendo_NWR. That's all, people. Thanks to Greg and James for joining me, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Later.